phones off and put them on silent. We're taking a video of the event. It'll be on our YouTube and our Twitter at FCCHK. Last month, we had author David Amer here at the club to talk about a sobering talk about the tensions between ethnic minorities in China, particularly in Xinjiang. It seems like all we hear about in Xinjiang is the turbulence between Uyghurs and the Han Chinese that's dominated the news lately, particularly in the last year. Today, we're about to hear a completely different perspective on Xinjiang, a more cultural and anthropological perspective, through Canadian photographer Ryan Pyle. For nearly a decade, our guest speaker journeyed across the province's often beautiful but often harsh terrain of desert, mountains, and grasslands. He tore down the ancient trade routes that form the Silk Road, travels that have been documented in his first photography book, Chinese Turkestan, a photographic journey through an ancient civilization. And by the way, all the images captured in his book were shot on film and not on digital. So. Pyle is an award-winning photographer whose images have been published in the New York Times, among other well-known publications. He also produced and presented TV shows. An interesting detail about Pyle is that he's quite the motorcycle enthusiast. He previously went on a bike trip with his brother Colin in the book and video called The Middle Kingdom Ride, and apparently it broke a Guinness World Record, 18 kilometers in 65 days. Clearly a daring traveler and a documentarian no less. Everyone, please give a warm welcome to Ryan Pyle.
Thank you all for having me today. It's wonderful to be here at the FCC in Hong Kong. And it's amazing to have a chance to share my work. I first traveled to China in 2001, fresh out of university. And right away, I pretty much decided it was where I wanted to live and work and spend my professional career. And in 2001, I actually moved to Shanghai, which is where I still call home. So I come to you today from Shanghai. We'll be talking about my Chinese Turkestan book, which was shot over an 8-year period from 2004 to 2012. It's all black and white, it's all shot in film, and it was very much because in 2001 I traveled to Xinjiang and really enjoyed the kind of ancient Silk Road atmosphere, but felt it was on the verge of being changed forever due to modernization, construction, especially infrastructure construction in the region. So it was kind of my goal to think about photographing it and recording it. So hopefully it has some kind of historical value in the future. So I'm just going to work you through a little bit of my presentation here. I am a photographer. I consider myself to be a documentary photographer. I try to be invisible. I try to capture life without interfering in my subjects' daily routines. I don't use flashes or anything like that. It's really about the natural moment, and as we work through the images, you'll see some more of that. I graduated from the University of Toronto in 2001. I moved to China full-time in early 2002, and then began working for the New York Times in 2003, 4, 5, and had a great career there. In 2007, started working for mainly magazines, and then in 2009, I was listed as one of the 30 emerging photographers in the world. And as I mentioned, living full-time in Shanghai. Here's a brief map of China. We can see that Xinjiang is the large province in the northwest of China, the orange one. Just FYI, to get from Shanghai, my home, to Urumqi, the capital of Xinjiang, takes 5 hours. It's a direct flight. And then to get from central Xinjiang, which is where Urumqi is, out to the border with Pakistan, is about another hour and a half. So I was able to visit for 8 years, 4 or 5 times each year, this region to make this book. And it was basically about a 6.5 to 7 hour journey from my home. Here's a map of Xinjiang itself. And you'll see Hotan down in the south, Kasha, which is Kashgar, in the west, and then Urumqi in kind of the central north, and Hami in the eastern region. These are kind of the main urban centers where I spent quite a lot of time documenting. And you'll notice that there aren't any cities in the middle. And that's because that's the Taklamakan Desert, one of the largest deserts in the world, one of the most inhospitable places on Earth. Xinjiang itself means new frontier. It was a name that kind of came up in the 1850s. Before that, it was known as Turkestan. Turkestan represented a larger region that involved also Central Asia. And I've named my book Chinese Turkestan, meaning that this is the part within the modern-day borders of China. Xinjiang is roughly 1/6 the total landmass of China, and it's 3 times the size of France, this one province in western China. It takes hours to days to drive across, and even hours to fly across in some regions. 14 different ethnic groups live within the region, and I actually photographed as many as I could, not focusing solely on Uyghurs, but there is a vibrant Kazakh, Uzbek, Kyrgyz, and Tajik community, and as well as Mongolians. You can find remnants of Genghis Khan's crew in the Tian Shan range still herding their little horses, which is pretty amazing. The Muslims that are in Xinjiang represent about 40% of all the Muslims in China, and population's roughly 26 million, of which about 8 million are Uyghurs, and they're the majority of the Muslims. So that's, I'm going to work through some pictures and just give you some background. This is in front of the Idka Mosque, and this man's trying on a new jacket that he's just bought at the end of the Big Friday Mosque, in front of the Idka Mosque at the Idka Square. It turns into almost like a big commercial market with so many people coming out of the mosque, so many people bringing their wares into the mosque area to be purchased. The region was actually Buddhist from India before it shifted to Islam in the 1330s. Of course, this is always debatable, but it kind of became a province of China at one stage. But as the Chinese Empire strengthened and weakened, this part of Xinjiang fell in and out of control of the Qing dynasty mainly. In the 1820s, China set up a program of assimilation where they started moving people out, Han Chinese people from Eastern China, out into the region to try to settle it and to try to have a stronger hold in the region. And then the last kind of 50 to 100 years and even beyond, it's been kind of squeezed between two superpowers, and it's been a very kind of comfortable buffer for China between Russia and the mainland, Eastern China. So the question is the region a barren wasteland or a vital buffer? And that's your image of a barren wasteland in the heart of the Taklamakan Desert. Here's a lady working through the market just outside of Kashgar. And this is still a very common practice that you see today. The markets are huge in this region and very photogenic and tell a lot about daily life. So my project was very much to document every aspect of life in Chinese Turkestan, because the region is really changing. This wonderful part of the world is losing its culture, its architecture, and its traditional way of life. And the ancient and mystic traditions of the Silk Road are on the verge of being lost forever. And what I witnessed from my home in Shanghai is that not only in minority regions, but in everywhere in China, is developing quite quickly. And with that, the beautiful essence of culture and architecture that exists in all of these cities and towns and villages is being lost and kind of being substituted for very generic architecture. We've all probably seen it if we've driven through China, those tile white buildings which are popping up everywhere. And walking through places like Kashgar, you can notice the change, and I'll have some pictures about that as well. Here's an old farmer in Hotan, in southern Xinjiang province. And like most farmers, he has two jobs. He farms when the weather is good in the summer, and in the winter, where this picture is taken, he resorts to carpet making to make ends meet. And this is actually a carpet factory in Hotan. And this is a Kyrgyz man, and you can tell by his hat. some different minorities wear different hats. And behind him is Musta Agata, and this is on the Karakoram Highway on the border between China and Pakistan, where a large Kyrgyz and Uzbek and Tajik minority live. This is a Uyghur man in Yingsar, which is about 2 hours south of Kashgar. And he's actually in his home. And behind him, his two children, he's passing on the tradition of knife making. And he makes knives in his home. And he's educating his children, the next generation, about how to make knives. And this is one of my favorite images. And it's a nice portrait, but it also shows how I try to use natural light with my photography and I don't use flashes. And that shot was taken because there was a large window kind of behind me, over my shoulder, which I was able to capture that with. A street scene in Kashgar. The market in the foreground is no longer allowed to set up shop on the road because there's so many cars in Kashgar now. And these kinds of street markets that used to exist are no longer allowed to take place there. They're pushed off the road into other areas. A night market in Kutra. Three generations of dumpling making, Uyghur dumpling. The older man is working with the pot in the foreground. His son is behind him preparing the dough, and the grandson in the picture is not in the image, but he's actually serving customers in the small shop. This man looks incredibly mysterious, but he's actually just reaching for his wallet to pay for his meal. Kind of looks like he's out of a Scorsese movie. Most of my photography, I don't try to work too much with silhouettes and shadowing, but this picture and this young boy's profile in the market as he lines up to collect his food was quite lovely, a nice moment. This is one of my, this is a picture I like quite a lot because it shows the facial features of a lot of the people who live in this part of the world. And you can see that they're very un-Chinese. And in many cases, you know, people would come up to me jokingly and say, hey, I could be your brother, especially when I had a big beard, which is what I usually had when I traveled to these regions, usually for about 2 weeks at a time. And he's actually cooking and also has a great hat. And this man preparing noodles in the winter. Melon on the street in Kashgar. A look at this part of the world would be quite incomplete if we didn't have a look at women, and there's a lot of women in this series. But one of the things that makes this picture, I think, quite unique is this woman is incredibly proud, back straight, shoulders up, and check out her high heels. She's not just walking through the Idka Square in front of the Idka Mosque in Kashgar. She's strutting through it. And I quite liked her the way she projected herself. This is Idka Square at the end of the Ramadan festival in Kashgar. And contrary to many people's, you know, beliefs, this was actually the only picture that I took in 8 years where I actually ran into any kind of police confrontation. I was able to pretty much complete 8 years of work in the region without having any problems, except this moment, I ran up the stairs to the roof of a hotel and I kicked open the door and ran to the edge so I could get this one shot. And obviously a lot of the police people were up there on the roof of the hotel watching the proceedings, making sure everything was peaceful. And that was where they started asking me what I was doing. But well worth it, I hope. Begging is very much accepted in the region. And here you have a lady with crutches, and she's getting donations on Friday after the main prayer. And you'll see this quite a bit. And you never quite know if they're actually handicapped or whether it's just their profession to beg or whether it's organized, as in some other parts of China. But everyone just seems to continue to give. A modern Uyghur man. This man had a cell phone. He was in the market. He's selling sheep and looks quite dapper in his hat. A young boy also in Hotan working at the same carpet factory. The future of the region. Sadly, the old laneways are becoming a thing of the past. And modern apartment blocks are starting to go up everywhere. Many people are divided on this. Some people living in the apartment blocks like it. They have things like natural gas to cook their stoves. They have indoor plumbing. It's warmer. A lot of people don't like it because the social fabric of the old laneways is being torn apart and people are now disconnected from their neighbors. Whereas when they lived in old laneways, that wasn't necessarily the case. So there's positives and negatives to each people, people I talk to about these kinds of issues. I don't know any mosque in the world that still does this, so I was quite excited when this man invited me up to the rooftop of the mosque, and he did the call to prayer, and he actually called with his own mouth. So in many cases in the Muslim world, you'll have a recorder, you'll have a speaker system. The mosque will have speakers that shoot out into the community, out into the villages nearby. But here in Kucha, this man actually stands on the top of the mosque, only on Fridays, and screams out to the local community that they can come to prayer. And a funny story, he actually made me sign a waiver in English that he made me write, but he couldn't read, that if I fell off the top of the mosque, I wouldn't try to sue him. But he was a lovely man, and we had lovely tea after. An example of some of the old laneways in Kashgar. So you can see the brick facade, usually covered by some kind of mud brick. And here, this neighborhood is under reconstruction. And there's been a lot of news the last kind of 6-7 years about old Kashgar being destroyed. And I think that that would be a little bit false of a title. What's actually happening is that old Kashgar is being torn down and rebuilt to better building standards. And they're providing bigger roads and access roads into the old neighborhoods. That's kind of more of what's really happening, and I have some pictures that show that as well. I'm sorry to show this picture while we're all enjoying our lunch, but this man has just carved open the carcass of a sheep, and he's holding the large intestine. And this is a very common practice at the end of Ramadan, whereby people slaughter sheep and then donate the meat to local communities or to poor people in the community. But it's very common. So all of old Kashgar and old Hotan and Hami even can be found people doing this. An old lady walks through the old laneways of Kashgar. A fully veiled woman, again, with some fantastic high heels, working her way through the old lanes of Kashgar. This should tell you how long I've been working on this project, because phone banks like that next to small shops don't exist anywhere anymore. Even people in Kashgar have mobile phones. And this was probably one of my first images taken back in 2003 or 4, where people actually still used these semi-public phones for a fee. Women in the old laneways of Kashgar. A boy headed home. Reconstruction of Kashgar. Brick building is big business these days as the cities rebuild themselves. And here's a brick making factory just outside of Kucha. And this is one of the truck drivers who drives the bricks from here into the cities to be used. One of my favorite faces that I found along many of my journeys. The markets are such big business and can create so much traffic in the cities that people now are escorted off the main streets into this dry riverbed to await the Sunday market. So you'll have people setting up shop there for a day or two and then leaving very early on Sunday morning so they can be first into the market. These two wonderful men are not twins, but great faces in Hotan. The markets are big business, money changes hands. Sheep, goat, camels, cow. Anything you can get your hands on. Many of these animal markets used to be in the city center. When I first made my trip to Kashgar in 2001, the main animal market on Sunday was actually in the city center. Now they've been moved out to the outskirts of town. And many of the animals are now no longer walked in, but carted in with trucks. Lots of children working on the Sunday in the Sunday market as well. This is my Marlboro man. He's one of the truck drivers. He has offloaded all of his sheep, and he's sitting back enjoying a cigarette, watching the chaos of the crowd below. Men bargaining and making a deal in the market. Cockfighting is big business, and I was lucky I got a good seat. Big gambling in the markets, and they take their cockfighting very seriously. This man is actually inspecting the skin of the bird's neck to make sure it's tough enough, because that is where the claws end up most of the time, and that can lead to the defeat. I've never seen a young boy whip a donkey quite like this. And as they're leaving the market in a village about 2 hours outside of Kashgar, his father's actually telling him to ease up on the donkey. Testing out horses, if you're in the market to buy. An old blacksmith working in his home. Young girl in a carpet factory. Old lady in her 70s. Making carpets in a carpet factory in Hotan, sitting next to the window in the early morning because it was the warmest place to sit and work at the same time. Shoe repair. Young boys making knives. Young girls learning the trade of carpets. Woman in central Kashgar who burns the hair off of sheep heads and preserves the meat over an open flame. Xinjiang is not all desert. Parts of it are incredibly lush due to the mountains surrounding it and the rivers that come out of those mountains and the complex irrigation system that exists. Farmer tending to his irrigation. Young girl picking cotton. A man breaking open a small dike to flood one section of his farm. An old lady in her 70s, still farming, which in her mind was a crime because she had three daughters. All three of her daughters married off and now live and work with their husbands' families, leaving her and her equally elderly husband to tend to their own farm. An example of the kind of hardship people can go through if they don't have male children. If they had had a male child, that male child would have stayed and taken over their farm. It's very rare for to see a woman this old working in the fields. An old man out with an axe to chop some wood. Young woman with baby collecting cotton on the borders of China and Kyrgyzstan. Water collection from rivers is still important in this region. Islamic festival in the desert, just outside of Hotan. Spent about a half hour with this woman. I met her at the entrance of the cemetery. Her husband had passed away a few months ago, and she was coming to pay her respects after Friday prayers. This is about 4,500 meters above sea level, and these women are Tajik, collecting water from the river. Very much part of the old Silk Road, a young man on a donkey with his camels. Collecting dung in the fields to be used for fuel for cooking. The vast landscapes. An old herder crosses a moon-like plateau. An elderly man still making knives. And the region is very much a region of leisure. These are not people that wake up every morning and try to find out how they can work for 16 hours a day. This is a culture that likes tea drinking, likes afternoon naps, and when at all possible, playing chess. So With that being done, I would very much like to open up the floor to any questions that you might have about my experiences in the region.
Thank you, Ryan. Okay, for Q&As, does anyone have any questions? If you do, please identify yourself, including the organization if you're with one. Anyone have any questions? Oh, lady at the back.
After 8 years, you must have taken several thousands and thousands and thousands of photographs. How have you distilled them to for your book and for our presentation today? And what do you look for when you're self-editing?
Self-editing is a horrible process. So I usually try to have a few trusted allies with me to go through it, because what's interesting in my eyes might not be interesting in someone who hasn't spent kind of 8 years there. So there has to be a real balance. But I think anything that shows the lifestyle, you know, the goal of this project and having a goal and sticking true to that mission statement of wanting to show the life, the culture, and to make it more of an anthropological look at the region and not necessarily a political one, was really important, because I felt like this is a part of the world that gets looped up into talks about terrorism and this kind of issue. And I thought that the region hadn't had just an honest look at what it was like to live there. And that was very much what I wanted to show, and we edited and towards that. And with regards to this edit today, I gave this exact same talk in LA about 2 weeks ago, and it was 2 hours long. So I went through each picture and gave like the full story, but we're a little bit more time constrained today. So it was just a bit of a brief look, but trying to look at children, women, ways of life, agriculture, trying to give kind of a broad spectrum. Thank you.
Any more questions? A gentleman at the front, and then.
I've seen from your pictures there are a lot of women in hijabs and burqas. How radicalized do you think this society is at all? And if it is radicalized, is this a new phenomenon in this region of the world? And do you think there's any interconnectivity with similar movements in Pakistan and Afghanistan?
I didn't feel that the region was very radicalized at all. There were some women wearing a full, you know, facial covering, but it definitely wasn't the norm. And among the men in the region, you didn't feel, speaking with them or listening to them, they were very much radicalized at all. You know, I think it's true in most parts of the world that, you know, 99% of us just want to make a living and support our families. And beyond that, they don't have much great ambition or much great kind of contact with the outside world. And that's what I very much found here. Although recently you have seen some incidents in Xinjiang, the killing of the imam at the Kashgar Mosque recently, which does, you know, yield itself to being really quite extreme. But, you know, during my travels in that part of the world, I never saw anything that even would allow me to believe that something like that could even happen. Although I wasn't looking for it, but it was quite shocking to see what happened a few months ago.
Any more questions? Gentleman at the back.
Good afternoon. I'm Dipankar Aaron, counsel from the Consulate General of India, and heartiest congratulations for an excellent work and a vision, and you put in 8 years to do this in an interesting part of the world. I was just wondering, when you, in all your travels, what language did you learn? Some local language to communicate with them?
I had no local language, so I had an assistant with me who spoke both English, Chinese, and local Uyghur. And it was the same assistant that worked with me for 8 years.
Perfect, thank you. And second, a slightly technical question on the you use black and white films, right? Or you and you scan them?
Yes, black and white film.
Right, so fair enough. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You know, I think working in film is a lost art. And I think as an artist or as a storyteller, the canvas that we choose to tell our story on is just as important as the story. And working in film is still a really kind of beautiful process.
Hi, Marcia Barham, music educator. I'm interested in, my questions are basically threefold. I'd like to hear about the education and what you saw. What were your responses to seeing that, and if you did take some photographs. The local music and culture, is the music disappearing in the indigenous music disappearing. And as a woman traveling there, what would your take be on that? Would it be a safe place to travel?
Okay. So for education, most of the educative buildings in the region are government-run, central government-run, so getting access to those wasn't an option. Photographing in schools is quite sensitive in China, so I didn't even really bother. So I wouldn't know too much about that, though I do know that children are taught in Mandarin Chinese, but they mainly speak Uyghur, the local language at home. With regards to music, definitely you could make a whole book just about music in the region and how that art is dying. Not only the taste or the respect for the local music, but also the musician, the instrument makers. You know, all of these instruments are handmade, and I do have some images from that that I did shoot, but these people are also kind of disappearing, and their children aren't interested in taking over the responsibility of maintaining that tradition. So I'm quite worried about what will happen when these kind of older instruments, these older instrument makers kind of retire, and what will happen then. And your third question was women traveling alone. I've met many Caucasian female travelers traveling through the region on their own, and they felt quite safe. They didn't wear a headscarf or anything like that, but they were quite modest and covered up with their clothing. You wouldn't want to wear a spaghetti tank top or anything like that, or short shorts. It's a little bit more modest. But and it was funny because I had met some people who had come from Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, and they had come from Kyrgyzstan directly into Kashgar. And one of the things they mentioned was just how much safer they feel being in Kashgar than being in Uzbekistan or Kyrgyzstan specifically. And I've been to those regions as well, and I felt much safer traveling around in China and in Xinjiang than I have kind of anywhere in Central Asia.
Any more questions? Oh,
yep.
Gentleman at the back.
As you live in Shanghai, have you done any studies of retaining images of the old buildings before they get destroyed and showing how Shanghai is changing?
Yeah, I think Shanghai is one of my favorite photographic topics. It's close to home, it is home. I've definitely photographed a lot. But haven't yet produced a body of work about how Shanghai is changing or developing. Maybe that'll be in the future, I'm not sure. But it's already quite a hot topic, and some very, very good photographers have already produced books on these kinds of subjects, so I'm not sure if it's still kind of an interesting topic to the general community. But, you know, walking through the old laneways, as I do quite often, you do see a lot of change. And I live in a modern high-rise building in Shanghai and live quite a modern Western life in Shanghai. So, noticing that and being aware of that's, obviously very important to me. And I've actually had a chance, luckily, to document a lot of the massive high-rise buildings. I worked for Mori of Japan for 5 years when they built the Shanghai World Financial Center, which was previously the tallest building in Shanghai, now to be outdone by the Shanghai Tower. Which is just kind of on the verge of being completed. So I had a chance to work on that for 5 years, which was an incredible job and gave you kind of a different feel about what it means to work on the 101st floor of a building with no windows or no floor.
We got a lady at the front and also the gentleman after.
Sorry. Did you develop your own film? And if so, what type of film were you using as well?
Okay, so I used Kodak Tri-X 400, and many of you will maybe laugh at this, but we'll see. I would shoot a year of film, usually 4 trips, and I would store them in my fridge in Shanghai, and I would take all of my film home to Toronto, where I had a lab that would process all of my film and create contact sheets for me. I've given this talk a lot at some photography schools, and the young kids are blown away. How would you shoot, 4 trips, maybe 500 rolls of film without looking at it for a year? And it was actually a beautiful way to work, because when you did get all the film processed, you were looking at it with fresh eyes. And although I had a notebook and I was keeping track of where things were taken and on what days, it really gives you a fresh perspective. not having that instant gratification of looking down at a digital camera all the time. So I use these very small range finders, Leica M6s, that take film. And to be able to work in that kind of environment where you don't have to look down and you're not even really able to review any of your work for a year was actually really satisfying, a really different way of working. And I'm doing it again now in black and white in another part of China, which will be another book I can hopefully produce in the next few years.
Oh, I might just ask, what's the fascination with, why did you opt to do black and white only?
I think when you travel in this region, you have to think about how you want to show it. And I really wanted to show it in a historical context. So, and I felt that that was best done using black and white. So I gave a gallery exhibition about 4 years ago on some of this work in Brighton, in the south of England. And I was standing next to one of my images, and a lady comes up to me and she says, "Oh, you must be the grandson of the photographer." And I said, "No, ma'am, I'm the photographer." And she goes, "But these were taken in the 20s, no doubt." And that's kind of, that was definitely one of the editing themes behind it, was to try to find some timeless element to the way that these people were living. And that was very special to the project.
We have a gentleman at the back.
You actually asked my question, but
oh, right.
So I will say, yeah. What if you wanted to shoot in color? What is it worthwhile shooting in color? Also, is it not that colorful?
Oh, it's absolutely colorful. I mean, you know, color or black and white is the taste of the artist alone. But I've done some color work in this region. I've done work for Travel and Leisure magazine and even for the New York Times, where I had to shoot in color, and the pictures are very vibrant and very beautiful. But for the longer term project, I really wanted to produce something in black and white that would really tell the story of the way of these people's lives.
We have the gentleman in the far right.
Hi, the pictures are really wonderful.
Thank you.
There isn't any picture showing interactions between Han Chinese and local people. But in the narrative, you said Han Chinese is actually the majority of the population. Can you say something about it?
Yes, so nowadays Han Chinese are both the majority in Xinjiang and in Tibet, and the book doesn't look at that relationship at all. Might be one of the misgivings of the book, but it was definitely a conscious effort by me to simply look at the local minority cultures and the way that they live. And to be honest, you would have had to go way out of your way to find integration between the two cultures. They don't mix. Everything is racial. Where you go to school, what kind of job you have, where you live, everything. You know, where you have your bank account, what kind of phone you use, everything's racial and kind of racially tainted in some way, shape, or form. So in a lot of the old neighborhoods in Kashgar and Hotan, you won't find any Han Chinese. And in the marketplaces, you don't find any Han Chinese either, unless they're security officers or police officers. And it was very much my goal in this project not to document kind of any police or security or anything like that as a way of showing this body of work.
Any more questions? Oh, you've got another one.
Would you think it's safe for Chinese, or somebody looking Chinese, to travel around that region in the way you did and take pictures the way you did?
I think everyone has their own risk level. And obviously we've seen issues in Urumqi a few years ago where some, you know, indescribable things happened to both Han Chinese and Uyghur people. For me as a Caucasian, usually with a pretty good sized beard, I was able to travel in the region very comfortably. Most people thought I was Russian. But then when I mentioned I was Canadian, people were also quite excited. You know, for a Chinese person to travel through the region, I think if you do so with respect, you know, I think if you travel with an open mind and a respectful heart, you can travel anywhere in the world and make friends. That's what I like to hope, anyways. Whether that's the reality is, you know, it depends on the particular situation. I would have a very different opinion if I got caught in the Urumqi incident of 2008, but luckily I wasn't there when that happened. And I haven't seen any violence in my 8 years in the region.
Any more questions? Gentleman at the front.
Thank you. Was there any event or thing that you really wanted to capture but you missed for some reason, and or maybe you did shoot it, but then a year later you figured out that the picture didn't work or something like that?
Yeah, there were a lot of issues like that. So obviously when you give yourself 8 years to get it right, you have a lot of leeway. So for example, the Ramadan festival, I kept getting the dates wrong. And then a couple times, you know, that one picture that I have of the Ramadan festival from the rooftop, it's way back there. You know, that took me going to like 4 Ramadans before I figured out I could get on top of that hotel. And you know, so there was, and that's when I really started to realize that the book was almost done, is when I started to repeat myself. And I'd been to so many areas and been to so many villages. Once I started to really notice, like, oh, I could do this better because I was here 4 years ago and this didn't happen. That was when I started to feel like the project was on the verge of being done. But there's definitely some repetition in the places I visited and the things I had seen, especially in the hubs like Kashgar. Because often my trips would start in Urumqi or Kashgar, and then I would travel by car to the more remote regions. Not by motorcycle, not at this stage, but I did that already, so that was fun.
Any more questions? I'll ask the last question. What's the, because we had a few questions about safety and violence and security. What's the biggest misconception about going to Xinjiang that you've encountered? And
I think the biggest misconception might be that Xinjiang is somehow like Afghanistan or Pakistan, and it's very much not. I could sit up here and tell you my reasons for an hour, but you'd probably have to go and understand it for yourself. You don't see people walking around with guns. You don't see tanks on the street. I don't feel scared walking in the region. So, you know, and for me, for my experiences, and I've traveled all through Central Asia, I've been to Iran 3 times for work. And I would definitely think twice about going to some parts of Pakistan for sure. Whereas I wouldn't have any hesitation at all going to Xinjiang. And I brought my wife to Xinjiang and my daughter on one of my trips. So she loved it. She loves the lamb kebabs, which are particularly spicy.
Well, thank you very much. His book is available over there. There's going to be a book signing as well. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, Ryan. Thanks for coming to this luncheon. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time, guys.